That's been studied.
Welcome everybody to the meeting at State Department Information Council. Meeting's being held under the Open Meeting Act, and notice has been posted appropriately on the front of the building for those that needed to know. If you would, I'd like to ask you to join me in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Well, as we do traditionally, we go around the room and introduce who we are and who we represent. And we'll start up here with the head table and work around, and we'll just go back and forth through the audience. So, Kathy?
Kathy Hines, Center for Spatial Analysis.
Jana Harris, SWODA. Andre Cruz, Oklahoma Department of Wildlife Conservation.
Craig Moody, Oklahoma Department of Transportation.
Mike Shagrew, Water Resources Board.
Mike Sharp, Conservation Commission.
Wade Patterson, Garfield County Assessment.
Jane Weber, Oklahoma Geological Survey.
Ted Wheeler, Oklahoma Department of Agriculture, Food and Forestry.
Steve Stadler, State Geographer.
Bureau of Land Use, Representative City Government.
Amy Brenton, Department of Environmental Quality.
Dick Clark, the Office of Management and Enterprise Services, previously known as the Office of State Finance.
Mark Gregory, Oklahoma State University.
Ted Bachman, Oklahoma Health and Social Security Services.
Dan Huff, Oklahoma Biological Survey.
Taylor Denniston, Berry Tree Lane Survey, processing, collect all of our LIDAR and Berry Tree information.
Larry Caldwell, Oklahoma Conservation Commission.
Jim Henley, Oklahoma Conservation Commission.
Shelley Willoughby, Office of Geographic Information.
Robert Toole, Oklahoma Conservation Commission.
Anna Stagg, Meshek and Associates.
Chris Hill with Meshek and Associates.
Charles Brady, City of Arkansas.
Susan Langley, Oklahoma Forest Reserve.
Brenda Pennell, Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma.
Michael Larson, Oklahoma State University.
Mariana Anderson, Virginia.
Gene Johnson, WRB.
Terry Smith, Justice for Life, sir.
Trevor Grout, Justice for Life, sir.
Bart Estes, Cobb Engineering Company. Zachary Collinsworth, Water Resources Board.
Brian Stinson, Surex Corporation.
Annette Phillips, Chief Foundation.
Chelsea Smith, Stan.
And Jantle, Washington County.
So, Alex Sundy, OMES.
Don Schrader, Home to Rhythm.
Matt Rollins, Water Resources Board.
Giannis Lucum, Water Resources Board.
John Phillips, WRB.
Ken Powell, Wildlife.
Brian Pauls, Aerial Data Service.
Okay, well, thank you everyone for being here. We do have a sign-in sheet. If you happen to miss that, appreciate you signing in, and we can keep you on the mailing list. We do have a quorum, so we can proceed with business. The meeting minutes for June have been circulated to council members. Are there any corrections, additions to the minutes, discussion on the minutes? If there are none, I entertain a motion for approval.
So moved.
Second.
Motion been made and seconded to approve minutes as published. Any discussion on that? Hearing none, those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Thank you. The minutes have been approved. Committee reports. Land cover, Dan, do you want to brief us on that?
Yes, I can. We're making pretty good progress here. We're working on phase one of the project, which is 30 counties in eastern Oklahoma. We received an additional $73,213 from OVWC for our part of the project, and our field worker, Katie Ewing, has so far collected data on 1,250 points in 21 of those counties. And she's working, her goal right now is 40 to 50 points per county. So she's making really good progress there. We sent the four-band make data and statewide DCAM to the Missouri folks, so they're working, they have that data. They're moving ahead. We'll be talking to them some next week to keep our coordination going. And if you're really interested, well, we can give you a poster at OKSCOG.com.
Any questions for me? Okay, Charles, on the address standards.
Address standards right now, we've got two or three phases of it. One of them is the required portion of the address standards that are going to have the points and the lines, and then, you know, left from, right to, right from, all those small components. They're the required fields, and then some optionals. We've got the required fields basically nailed down. Some of the domains and some of the values are going in there. Working with Nina, trying to get some of the ESN numbers for the state, so we have a full coverage of that. If anybody would be interested in looking over that and seeing how it would apply to your data, you're more welcome to holler at Mike or Shelley or myself, and we'll toss you the Excel file, kind of review over that, and after we get some feedback, we'll proceed from there. So,
once we've kind of gone over this first round, we'll post it out to the list so we can get everybody to buy it.
It's not to go out there and say this is the way you're going to have your address data. It's saying here are the fields that are needed. It can be labeled whatever you want to label. This is kind of the recommended, but you can label whatever you want to as long as those fields are there and they have a certain detail. It's text versus numeric. It's, you know, certain values in the domains, things of that nature, certain links. Just trying to keep it to where if you want to take and merge all the data together, you can actually do that fairly well.
For comments, yes.
Well, we will eventually. This isn't right now. Okay, I guess that's all we've got to review currently for committees. Anything small?
Do we need to do the hydrology? Is anything?
Yeah, Mike, is anything new?
I guess since our last council meeting, we did have a meeting following the SCOG presentation in Norman. It went really well. It was kind of a kickoff type meeting. One of the big things that came out of that was kind of comparing what the NHD offers versus the Tiger blind files for the hydrography. And one of the things that I'm going to look at, I have not had a chance to do, was try to get a hold of somebody with the Census Bureau and identify where the Tiger hydrography data comes from. Kind of get a comparison of that percentage. One of the things we looked at was why they're different. And you know, it's a different scale, of course, the NHD being the 24K versus, I think the Tiger's still 100K. And then, we'd like to talk to somebody there. See. So we'll probably have another meeting before too long. Summer vacation.
Okay. Next item. It's that time of year for the budget. Legislation that governs Office of Geographic Information says that the budget will be submitted through the Conservation Commission's budget. So we've been doing that every year since it came about, and it's always gone the same place, nowhere. But it hadn't stopped us from submitting one. And so that's what has been circulated around to commission or council members to review. It's really much different than it has been in the past, the basic budget. There's uncertainties in there, of course, as far as, you know, software and computers, and in light of things that are going on over in the IT department, consolidation, IT systems, how that will, if it would impact OGI, all those are unknowns. We're just kind of floating out there, and we'll just see what develops. So, anyway, if you have any comments or questions about the budget, I'll be happy to try to answer those. If not, we'll submit this to Conservation Commission for the submittal next month. That's to be end October 1st to owners. And if there are any discussion, I'll entertain a motion.
So moved.
Second.
Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor of approving the proposed budget, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Thank you. We will get this submitted. Thank you. Okay, next time we're the highlight of the day. We've got a presentation on LIDAR by a couple of gentlemen from the Conservation Commission. Both these guys are former NRCS employees. Larry Caldwell, state engineer for many years. Jim Henley, the GIS manager for NRCS for many years. And we're just thrilled to have them working with us now on projects and bringing their expertise to these kind of things. And I'm just going to turn it over to you guys and do what you want to do and show us what you've been up to for the last couple of years or so on this project.
Very good. Thank you, Mike.
Get that fired up, Mike?
Yeah, hit that.
Very good.
Well, I appreciate this opportunity to talk about some of the good work that's going on at Oklahoma Conservation Commission and some statewide efforts that we're doing some new work with some pilot projects that's going to be implemented nationwide as we go through here. This is going to be a tag team between Jim Henley and myself. I'm going to start out just giving you a real high-cut overview on watershed program in Oklahoma and the importance of that to this state. Then Jim's going to talk about some nuts and bolts on the LIDAR acquisition that has been made in order to make this project possible, and then go through some of the nuts and bolts on developing maps for breach inundation, that if a dam should fail, what area would be flooded downstream. Then we're going to end up with a few slides on a pilot program that we have going on using those maps and incorporating them into a system, a monitoring system called DamWatch. So that's kind of our plan of attack here for the next several minutes. Small watershed program, don't know how familiar you all with it are with this program. It's very important to the state of Oklahoma, starting back in 1948. It's been very important for addressing primarily flood control, municipal water supplies, recreation facilities, and so forth. When you look at the amount of damages that would have occurred had these dams not been in place, it comes out to an average annual figure of $83 million. So you took on an average annual basis, it's $83 million of benefits, and that's really averting damages that would have occurred from flooding and from other natural resource calamities there had those dams not been in place. Since 1948, there's been 2,107 of these watershed dams that have been constructed across the state. That's more than any other state in the nation. There's almost 12,000 of these dams nationwide. 20% of them are here in Oklahoma. As you can imagine, through the 50s, 60s, and 70s, there was a tremendous effort on getting the dams planned, designed, constructed, working with landowners. Most of these are constructed on private lands with easements through the conservation districts, local conservation districts. In the past several years, the emphasis nationwide on dams have gone to public safety threats in terms of preparedness on looking downstream in case a problem develops with one of these dams. I think we're probably a little biased, but we believe these watershed dams are probably engineered better than the average dam across the country. But even with that, we don't want to have a false sense of security that nothing can happen. There have been some efforts or some incidents across the country where even some of these watershed dams have failed before. It's not something that you lay awake nights worrying about, but it's something you need to be prepared for. None of these are in the state of Oklahoma, by the way. But these are. There was a couple after the remnants of Hurricane Erin back in 2007. Those on the left, was one dam down in Caddo County that got very, very close. If you see on the top here, this is the top of the dam. There was just a sliver there left before it would have broke through. This one here is up in north central Oklahoma where there was some piping. So it can happen. When most of these dams were built, they were built to protect agricultural areas downstream. And the saying, build it and they will come. That's kind of what happened on some of these, where people wouldn't think of building downstream from some of these dams before because they were so frequently flooded. The dams provide flood control, and now there's houses being built downstream, in some cases subdivisions. So that gets into a hazard classification change. Instead of a low hazard, now there's people's lives that could be threatened if that dam should fail. So that makes it into a high hazard dam. There's now 229 dams across the state that are now classified as high hazard. That's not an indication in terms of physical condition. It's just the if the dam should fail, are people's lives at stake? A couple of years ago, we had an opportunity to be involved in some, in a project to do assessments on dams. There was 658 assessments completed nationwide. 147 of those were approved to be completed in Oklahoma. It was completed from October 2009 through September of last year. There was an agreement between NRCS and Oklahoma Conservation Commission to complete those, and those assessments included doing breach inundation studies to map the areas downstream. This year, we're doing an additional 26 maps on additional projects. So on the breach analysis, that's really used to verify the classification to determine, is there any threat for loss of life if that dam should fail? It determines the area downstream. If the dam should fail, what area would be inundated, and identify any at-risk properties. At this point, I'm going to turn it over to Jim Henley, and he's going to talk about some of the nuts and bolts issues of how this is developed using LIDAR and the processes we have.
This right button on this side.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And the laser there is at the center.
Okay. Well, in doing this project, you know, we were going to use a lot of modeling, which the HEC GeoRAS and HEC RAS are programs developed by the Corps of Engineers to model hydrology. And the HEC GeoRAS links up with ArcView or ArcMap. We used ArcMap 9.3, and we used LIDAR data, where, you know, as much of it as we could where it was available. When we started this project, we were able to procure LIDAR data in the Ouachita Basin, and we have a lot of our flood control structure in the Ouachita Basin, so most of them were covered. We did have to do a few using 10-meter data, but the bulk of it was done with the LIDAR. And I'm sure that most of you in here have heard of LIDAR or know what LIDAR is, but you know, light detection and ranging, airplanes flower with showering the ground with laser pulses, and the return, different returns give you a look at the terrain. This is just an example of two products that we typically ask for when we get a LIDAR buy. We want the what they call the first return data. This is just a hill shade, but the first returns give you an idea of the vegetative patterns on the land, but you can't see all of the details of the drainage pattern. We also get a product called the bare earth product, which is on the right, where they can actually strip off all of the vegetation, the houses, and all we see there is just the actual surface of the ground, just like it was burned off or stripped off, and get pretty accurate elevation values. There's another example of a first return, you know, like a town versus a bare earth. Our LIDAR coverage now, this covers everything that we've purchased up through 2012, and the areas that are in light blue are currently, we're currently purchasing those right now. We're just completing that contract, and they're going to become available. The purple area is the Ouachita Basin. You know, we had it blown in 2010. The green area up in Garfield, Noble, and parts of Payne was done in 2011. So we're getting a big chunk of the state covered. You wonder kind of why the pattern is that away. It has a lot to do with our watershed program, you know, where a lot of our watershed dams are clustered. We want to, the NRCS anyway, wants to make maximum use of the LIDAR in helping them design and look at their flood control structures that they have some responsibility over. Areas around Oklahoma City and the metro areas of Oklahoma, they probably going to be picked up with LIDAR, or they may already be at the even higher resolution. Most of this stuff is just two meter resolution data. Products you can develop from LIDAR is that they make pretty good contour maps. The 2 meter data, we try to spec it out where it's good for 2 foot contours that would meet standard for 2 foot contours. So you can produce contours with it. NRCS uses it on stage storage information to develop a stage storage curve, which they need if they want to redesign a dam. You need to know if you raise it 10 foot or 5 foot or whatever, how much storage is going to be there. These LIDAR grids do a very good job of calculating some of the stage storage, at least down to the water level, where you begin to need a bathysphere survey. When we get the LIDAR, one thing NRCS likes to do is check it, you know, do a rough check on it to make sure that it's close to what it should be. You know, we don't have a lot of survey points to check. The contractors will establish a base level to adjust off of, and they'll have survey points, and they use those to gauge their accuracy. But those are all taken on flat, bare surfaces that should give you very, very good results. You know, we've looked at some of our flood control structures where we have actually as-built data, the actual survey elevations that the spillway should have been cut to and the top of dam. This gives us we can compare those, you know, cutting some profiles off the LIDAR. You can see on the top graph the green line and the red is what the as-built elevations show. The blue line is the elevations that we have picked up off the LIDAR. So they're very, very close. And we would expect a little bit up and down as you vegetate those spillways. You're going to get a little changes in elevation. But when we start seeing it match up that well, we're pretty satisfied. We're getting a good product. Our soils, NRCS soils mappers, will use it to create slope maps, contour maps, flow direction maps for delineating watersheds and things of that nature. But there's the comparison of a 10 meter DEM versus a high resolution LIDAR. And there's some more comparisons. But what I really want to talk about is I just wanted to use LIDAR to bring you up to, you know, that the product we were using was a very good elevation grid for our models. And to develop a breach in using the Corps of Engineers HEC GeoRAS program, the first step is to digitize the stream center line. Then we digitize cross sections. And we typically use a topo map to locate cross sections. And I found out from experience, you know, after you do a 100 or so of these, those cross sections are pretty critical on how you position them. You want them to transition well. Otherwise, your models, you begin to get what they call hydraulic jumps, where it can't transition from one cross section correctly to the other. So you kind of, but we'll set the cross sections on there. Typically, after we locate the cross sections, I'll go back and create a hill shade with the LIDAR data, so I can see any anomalies that are out there that we may, you know, want to miss, or you can see the shape of the valley floor better if you use a hill shade, and we'll adjust those cross sections using that hill shade data, and that's been very, very effective. It gives us a real good look. That's what all you're looking for in those cross sections is you want it to define that valley. And the HEC GeoRAS program, or the HEC RAS program, it takes those cross sections and then it creates what it's called interpolated cross sections. Every 20 or 30 feet, it may put an interpolated cross section just so it can flow. But you want it to flow. But that's the first step is to get that data put together. There's a hill shade of LIDAR that we would use to make sure our cross sections are looking correctly. Once we get those in there, you use HEC RAS and do an unsteady flow. We have a hydrologist, Ray Riley, who takes care of the hydrology portion of this for us. He takes the output file from the HEC GeoRAS program, brings it into HEC RAS, and does an unsteady flow equation on it. We'll also calculate if we have bridge openings. We typically, he does the bridges and box culverts on highways anyway. But many times the LIDAR will, on the bare earth, will strip out the bridge so you can see the drainage pattern. And they do a pretty good job of giving you an opening that pretty well matches what the bridge is. You don't have quite the
resistance of the water going through there, but it's pretty close in many instances. But once we have that, I can bring it. HECRAS will generate a export file. And we've been using the version 4.1 of HECGeoRAS, which has a program in there called RASMapper. And RASMapper is new to 4.1, but it uses, you convert your LIDAR grid into a floating point grid. And it will use that floating point grid to calculate a breach area. And it makes a pretty smooth line. The old versions used to give you more of a stair step look. This does a better job of transitioning through there. And it creates both the shape, it creates a shape file within RASMapper. And it also creates a flow depth grid. And the light blue area is a depth grid. And you can see it a little better on this map. The yellow outline would be the breach. The light blue area would be the various flow depths of the water moving through that breach system. Well, we plot those. When we make a map, we go ahead and plot it at 1 to 24,000 on a 1 to 24,000 scale. If our breach is longer than that, we may have multiple panels. But we try to show everything on 1 to 24,000 or larger scale. We locate the what we call potential damage locations. These could be houses, bridges, railroad crossings, any place that where the water is coming across that could endanger life would be considered a potential damage location. And they're plotted. You can see some of the identifying numbers going to the I think we may have a little closer shot. Each one, like the UCB, that's a unique number assigned to that potential damage location. And we maintain a statewide database, and each one of those locations is cataloged into that database. What happens typically in a watershed system, that same house may be impacted by three or even four different dams, but it would be impacted at different depths. So rather than rediscover the wheel every time we, you know, if you do dam X and Y this year, dam Z next year, it's going to hit the same house. You've already captured that data. And all you do is compare that same point with the flow depth grid to get the actual inundation depth and time to inundation. So it was a little bit of work to set up a database, but it's working very well for us, and so we know what dams impact what houses. Also, for this project, we photographed each one of those damaged locations, and you can see examples of the photograph. Those photographs are labeled with the same identifying number as we have on the map. So you can match the photograph with the number on the map. We did one other thing that was kind of interesting. When you start locating houses out there and trying to photograph them, rather than try to photograph, keep a lot of notes as to what house goes with what dot, we use cameras that geotagged all of our pictures. And I used a little extension in ArcMap called ArcPhoto. ArcPhoto took a geotagged JPEG and created a points file from it. So all of a sudden I had all my photographs with points files attached. So it made it real easy to catalog all those photos to make sure you had the right house. That was a huge time saver. Because as long as you got a good geotag photo, you are very close to where the actual house was, so you could just edit your points files to move it to the house. And that worked very well for us. Each one of those different colored dots, either is a house or a bridge,
ties to the water depth, whether it's 1 to 3 foot or greater than 3 foot or less than a foot. So we use different color dots on our maps to indicate the water depths. The other thing, this is part of that database that we put this table on each one of those maps. It shows the ID of the potential damage location, roughly what it is, whether it's a business, a house, it could have been a church, a school. Some of them were cabins, you know, seasonal used cabins. How many structures you can see, the camper trailer, there's 23. That would have been a little RV park that would have been affected. We have the depth, and that's the foot from ground level, not the floor elevation of the house, but we use just the depth from the water depth from the ground level. And then we put the time to peak flow, which that's the time that it would take if the dam did breach for the water level to hit its maximum level. And we did that for each PDL so you can see exactly what's going to happen if that dam should breach and roughly how much time you would have before it would get to any. Some of them were very quick. Some of them were, you know, up in the, you know, 4, 5, 6 hours on some long breaches. And with that, Larry is going to talk a little bit more about how we took these shape files of the PDLs, the breach boundaries, and incorporated them into a interactive dam watch system. And he can explain that.
Thank you, Jim. So you see, now that we've got all of this good data, now it's a matter of how do you share that information? How do you get it to the people at the time when you may need that? I don't know it's not surprising. A lot of dam failures, emergencies don't always happen between 8 and 5. And it seems like they usually happen on weekends or Friday nights or Sunday mornings or whatever. But getting access to that information, and not just the breach maps themselves, but the original construction drawings, any inspection records, or any history on repairs or whatever, is nice to have. Many times it may be in a file cabinet, and you need to know from that office which office it's in, where it's located, and so forth. So we were really looking for some means of having a web-based system. We came across a system at an Association of State Dam Safety Officials conference about 3 years ago, and they had a system called BridgeWatch. And it was set up with the same system only for bridges. And the more we looked at it, that, you know, a dam is nothing but a bridge with a hole filled in. And you go from there. It has a lot of the same records. You have a lot of the same information. It's hydrology based. So we started talking with U.S. Engineering Solutions, who had that bridge watch system, to see if it could be converted to dams. They had already done a small pilot in Connecticut with about 70-some dams. And after a period of time of talking about a proposal and talking with the NRCS National Office, we got approval to get some special funding for doing a pilot. And the Oklahoma Conservation Commission was a big part in dealing with this pilot. Why Oklahoma? We sold on the fact that there's 2,107 dams, 20% of those nationwide. A lot of the data was already electronic. We'd had scanned drawings, operation maintenance agreements, a number of documents associated with those, so they're already in electronic form. The contract was signed in December as a 2-year duration going through the test. As I say, it was from U.S. Engineering Solutions. It's a patented web-based system for access of data. They received the ASDSO Regional Award for merit a couple years ago. It has a lot of features, but there's really three main features I'd like to highlight. One is that it tracks real-time precipitation events and sends alerts to predetermined people. And we'll show this in a minute, but an example of it. But the drainage boundary of each of these dams, the 2,107, are digitized. So you've got a prescribed area that drains toward that dam. That is tied into the radar system in the National Weather Service, and as that radar goes across that drainage area, it quantifies, makes an estimate of how much precipitation has occurred on that drainage area. And then we'll compare that to a threshold. If it exceeds that threshold, then there's automatic alerts that go out by cell phone or email to predetermined people to let people know that that spillway on that flow, on that structure, could be flowing soon. So that's a huge advantage of this. It stores and retrieves all the electronic data that you put into it is as good as what you have, but these breach maps that Jim described are very valuable information if you have a problem with a dam. The as-built construction drawings, the emergency action plans, any photos, inspections, it'll do videos, it'll do audio, design data, can all be accessed through that system. And then there's a system in there for maintaining what they call tickets. That's where if you have a repair that's needed, you can schedule it in advance and it gives you reminders. If someone goes out and takes a look at a problem, they can take photos. There's computer tablets that go with these, so you can go out and you can download anything off the internet onto that tablet while you're there, the drawings, reports. If you see something that doesn't look right, you can take a photo, you can upload it, somebody can look at it real time in another office. So, and these tickets allow you to keep up to date on what's happening on a site where different people make different entries and you can come back and do it. When you look at the need for this, it seems like when it rains, it doesn't rain in just one small spot. It seems like this year it hasn't rained anywhere, but I'm convinced if it doesn't rain this year, it's going to rain again. If not next year, surely the year after. But when you look at some of the rains that we have, they're usually widespread areas. And if you remember that watershed map with all those dots, and a lot of times these large storm events can cover several hundred dams. So it's a large area, and then you have to start figuring out where you're going to put your resources for the conservation districts and Conservation Commission, NRCS, to be looking at these dams. So knowing which dams to check first becomes a challenge. And it's okay as long as all of the dams are functioning as they properly in terms of a uniform flow, there's no erosion. When you start getting some head cuts and some erosion, you start getting concerned, and in some cases it gets to be a real concern. So identifying those dams that had the most flow, that are the most potential for damage, is the first challenge. And getting out and looking at these dams, you just don't want to go out driving across the countryside look there, because traveling to the dams themselves can be dangerous. And you always hear about not driving through water. You don't know what happened to that culvert or that bridge that you're driving through that can cause a problem. So it's a safety issue also on identifying going those only ones you need to go to early. And when people are at risk and evacuations may be needed, timing is critical. You don't have time to go and start digging through records and trying to find those records. You need to have them accessible quickly. So getting prepared when the sun is shining, when storms, or when the lake levels are down at normal level, that's the time to get prepared so that when the storms hit, you're prepared and you can use that data. This real-time precipitation, as I mentioned, that it tries to quantify the precipitation over the drainage area. When it gets to that threshold, it'll email or cell phone predetermined people for that dam. Generally, that's a conservation district who are the sponsors and responsible for operation maintenance on the dams, NRCS, the Conservation Commission, dam safety officials, and some selected emergency management officials. The threshold, we have two thresholds in Oklahoma. One is, if you look at this, if this is a normal pool, and when you get the big storms, the runoff comes down and is temporarily detained behind this embankment, and then it slowly flows out the principal spillway pipe. That's how it gets the flood control. But when you take that storage from this level up to the level of just before it goes through the auxiliary spillway, that detention pool would figure out how much rainfall it would take to fill up that pool. And that's the threshold. So it's computed for each individual dam because each one's have different storages. So then it compares those two, and when that happens, then you go out with the alerts and everybody gets that advance alert that dam could be flowing through the spillway. The second level is when you get 2 inches precipitation beyond that. So that means at that point, you should be having a lot of flow through the auxiliary spillway. And then that's one area. The other area, if you have a high hazard dam, that's one you want to pay some attention to because there's people living downstream. If you know of some dams that might have a problem with maintenance or some repair issues or whatever, you could highlight those so you can begin to prioritize the dams that had heavy rainfall so you can better utilize the resources you have. This is not open to the public. It's assigned users and passwords. There's about 180 users on the Oklahoma Dam Watch system as it is now, primarily conservation districts and NRCS and a few others. Those are generally the folks that are signed up as users. When you come to the system, this is the home page. It shows a map of Oklahoma, and you have various icons that we'll go through. First, when you want to take a look at all of the projects that you have there, you can go up to select a project, and the options that's there right now, you can select a project. You can select a county, a town. We don't use the towns and hucks. We could add in congressional districts. You could add in any political boundary that you want. But if in this case here, if you, we'll come back to these. This is, these are the different icons. If you want to look at information on dams, you click on that one, users, a navigation system. These are precipitation events, the radar systems with the Weather Service, USGS, stream gauges, Weather Service warnings. We don't have anything on the slosh on the hurricanes or seismic yet, or snowtail, but we do have some project information. So when you take a look at this, if you go to geography and select a project, that'll show a listing of the 129 watershed projects that are in Oklahoma. If you click on Stillwater Creek, next it shows that this is the outside boundary of the watershed project, Stillwater Creek Watershed Project around Stillwater. There's 34 dams there. Each one of those gray icons is a dam. You can click on one of those and it'll come up with the National Inventory of Dams number and the name of that dam. And it'll come up, this is Lake McMurtry up by Stillwater. So you take a look at that. This is the drainage boundary. This is the area that everything drains toward that particular lake. This is what is compared to in the National Weather Service as far as the area that it would compare the threshold to. So when you get the radar system coming across there, it'll quantify the amount of rainfall that comes down. We have a 75% basin in there that if 75% of the basin gets that rainfall amount, an alert goes out. Other features on here is design information, general information about that dam, when it was built, who were the sponsors, the lat and long, and how many people at risk downstream, the good design numbers in terms of storages and heights and drainage areas and all that information is there. This goes to the Weather Service. These are the various radars that have coverage over top of that dam and that drainage area that can provide information that's tied into. You go to documents. You could have the agreements, the inspections, the maps, the emergency action plans, where you can download those as you need them, whether it's agreements or construction drawings, whatever, you can download that from the system. The piece that Jim was talking about, the breach inundation areas, can be superimposed over top of the Google Map aerial base. So this is the area that was computed to be inundated if that particular dam should fail. Each of the triangles here are one of those potential damage locations, those PDLs that Jim was talking about. If you go and click on one of those triangles, it'll come up with a description, the unique ID number for it, what it is, a mobile home in this case, the depth of water, the time to peak for the flood peak to get there, and then a photo of that unit. That can be some very valuable information when you need it in a hurry if there is a problem with that dam. We have this now for about 170 of those dams. Another nice feature, if you have new employees or people that are coming in to help with inspections after an event, you can have a navigation system. So if you're wanting to go from your office to a house or to a dam, or if you're at one dam and you want to go to another dam, you put in the two locations and it'll give you turn-by-turn directions and also show on the map how to get from that place to the other during emergencies, during inspections. That can be useful for people that may not be familiar. This is, I think, another example of a good partnership between federal, state, local, and private with individual landowners out there on the watershed program that has been demonstrated for the past 60 years or more. This is using some new technology that's available both for determining the maps as well as accessing that information. We're going to use this for as a pilot and then evaluate at the end of the pilot period on whether to go nationwide. It was so obvious that this exceeded people's expectations as we got into it. Felt that there's no need to wait till the end of the two-year period. So there's now a nationwide contract, a competitive contract that has been out and in the process of awarding that contract. So this system that Oklahoma has been piloting for the last year and a half is now going to be expanded nationwide and cover all 12,000 of these watershed dams in 47 states. So that'll be a big undertaking that's going to begin here soon. And then as they start loading their data, this will be available for those project dams. When we talk about watershed dams, those are dams that were constructed through USDA-assisted programs, watershed program and a couple of other programs, again, primarily through the local conservation districts that are the sponsors, the local sponsors for those dams. So So those are the systems that we're looking at going nationwide. So with that, I don't know how we're doing time-wise.
About 5 or 6 more.
Okay, so we've got some time for any questions on either the system or on Jim's work that he's done on the breach mapping.
Any questions? What are you going to do ARPA 2010?
Excuse me?
What are you going to do the Water Board's 2010?
It's just money. Right now, and we're getting that question a lot around is, you know, this, if we can do it for these 12,000, why can't we do it for another couple thousand or whatever? Right now, the contract is set up for those 12,000. I think Oklahoma is in a, this is a personal opinion here, but Oklahoma is in a perfect position that this system has been piloted. All of the base geographic information, the hydrology information, the weather surface information is all in that system. And what better place to pilot having a tab in there for the watershed dams, have a tab in there for the non-project dams, the other ones that are in there, have a tab in there for the bridges and DOT, because all of that is based upon exactly the same levels across there. And all of those could impact one another. If you have a dam, a problem with a dam, it could affect a bridge. If you have a problem with a non-project dam that's upstream from a project dam, it could affect that one. And what better way than to have all of those programs that involve the same natural resource data on one system and accessible.
I have a question.
Yes.
Do adjusters have access to that information in case of a breach? I mean, can they go in there and analyze how much it may cost if there a breach ever happens?
I don't think it's been used to that level.
Also, do you have, are you digitizing the structures inside those breach areas, by chance, the building structures where you put that on a layer?
It's a points file.
It's just a points file.
And how do you get the points? Are you a photo and turbine aerial photography, or how are you finding all those PDFs?
On the first 141 that we did, we actually went to the field. We produced maps showing the breach boundary. We went to the field and actually drove those boundaries out and photographed and created geotag photos for each one of those structures. You know, whether it be a bridge or a railroad crossing or a house or a business or a church. That's pretty time consuming and pretty labor intensive. What's starting to be a little quicker shortcut now is Google Maps has begun to get some very high resolution, you know, and even some of it with almost leap off. And you can actually see how almost better than you can driving the roads and trying to look through the fence lines and the brush. And for communities, the street view, you know, you can actually go down through in a small community, you could go down the city street and actually look at the house in the breach and get a good description of it, or grab a screenshot rather the short story is the remote sensing with the high resolution photography that we're starting to become available is almost better than trying to drive it out.
I might suggest, if I noticed you had Garfield County, if you would simply send us that shapefile and say, here's what it looks like, we can pull up every parcel that's in there and we've got the measurements of the houses.
Do you have a points file of the houses?
No, but if we had the actual shapefile, we could go in and then put points on
that. That's something that we really wanted to explore, because a points file would be so easy to take your breach boundary and just select out of that and then tie it all back to the assessor information. I mean, that would be the Cadillac.
Would those files also have the property owner and contact information?
Yeah.
That's the other piece of this, that when you come into that emergency, you want to know not only which houses are impacted, but the contact information to get to those people, and that'd be another.
The only thing we would like, we don't keep phone numbers in the system.
Okay.
But yeah, there's a ton of stuff that we can give you and save you
That would have been, we knew that would be great. Each assessor seems to be a little different.
All assessors are different.
Well, I am convinced that, you know, there's a big effort, as you can imagine, just getting the system set up and what kind of information, how do you access it and get the links corrected and all that. Once you get to that level where this is now for these project dams, I'm convinced it's just a matter of the only thing that limits you is your imagination here. That, you know, when you have bridges, you've got all the construction drawings, you've got the agreements, you've got the USGS stream gauges, you've got all of that.
You can have access to it.
Well, and
point files.
It would seem to me that would be beneficial for this also.
Absolutely.
To be able to draw down, so you know what the bridge openings are, you know the age of the bridge, you know what the span is, you know what the, and you tie that together with USGS stream records. You've also got the non-project dams that are out there.
As well as the floodplains.
And the floodplain map. I mean, once you get that structure in place, now it's just a matter of adding additional layers and accessing different pieces for that program. I think Oklahoma has a huge opportunity here to take advantage.
Won't the bridge information help your modeling too?
Yeah, and I'm figuring that in there. I didn't point that out. One thing we did do on the, we used the ODOT digital bridge information, which is it's on most state and federal highways that actually had digital information that told us whether it was a box culvert, there's I-beams, how wide the bridges were, and to the extent that we could use that, we used that to design our bridge openings. You know, on some of the smaller roads, local roads, where, you know, we did have to go out and look.
It's 20 foot or less. We don't document, but we're working with the Association of County Commissioners right now to develop a data collection standard so all 77 counties collect the data the same way, and that will be one of those items that's collected, and culverts and boxes.
Would that be culverts also?
Yes, sir.
Box.
The one piece of information we would have liked to have, LIDAR helps, but we didn't have the bridge floor elevation, you know, the deck elevation.
Right.
The deck elevation would have been really nice.
Okay.
It just been a piece of note.
We should have that information.
I think it's on PDF hard copies. It's just not a field in the.
Is it? Let me look into that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we appreciate your time. I think this is another example of these. We've got this resource out here of 2,000 flood control dams, and this is just one more resource that we have to use as these dams get older. And we get the big events and you got more people down there, it's just one more resource that we have to get some additional benefit out of this watershed program. Yes?
Noting on the LIDAR, that's really an amazing asset to be developing. It looks like in this 2012 cycle, you're going to have a little over half the state then.
Correct.
Are there plans for doing the remainder of the state, or is this just all project specific?
Right now, the primary effort for acquiring this was for the dams. There's of those 2,100 dams, there's about 2,050 that were not covered by LIDAR. So that was the main emphasis for what areas were done. Then, of course, they could be used for a number of different areas.
And David, the AML program through the Conservation Commission, they purchased, piggybacked onto that contract and purchased an area to help them with some of their strip mine design information
I don't know if there's going to be any future opportunities to partner with NRCS on any future LIDAR flights, but if there is, that would be a great opportunity for, you know, tribes, other local communities to join in and get more bang for your buck here.
Well, they are trying to see if they can scrape up some end-of-year money and looking at catching a couple other priority areas. We identified, in addition to what you saw on our 2012, they had a couple other priority areas, some of them down in where the Wetland Reserve Program had a lot of activity along the Red River Basin, but they're going to make another shot in this year to hear more. So if there is any interest, you might want to contact Chris Stoner.
We always go on the concept that you always want to have about five proposals sitting on the corner of the desk. When you get the phone call, you can act on a moment's notice and take any money from any other state that might not be able to do that. So, there's another question.
Michelle.
Yes.
I'm just wondering if your emergency manager, would they apply for a login for the dam launch or,
I think that would best happen through the county, through the conservation, local conservation district, and have a discussion so everybody knows what the basis of this is. Because you want to have some, you don't want to open this up, because when somebody, people get some alerts, might react, let them know that that's an indicator, that's not an absolute dam failure situation.
So, till then, we have, you know, 10 and a half counties of jurisdiction, we have MOUs in place with those local jurisdictions. So go through that process.
What area are you?
Southeastern Oklahoma, Choctaw Mission, historical boundary.
That's something we probably need to talk about and see about adding on some other.
So we, you know, call incident command system with whatever jurisdiction.
Yeah. And I'd have to say that this is a, we're coming to the tail end of a pilot, of the Oklahoma pilot. Oklahoma is going to be tied into this national system when it gets up and running. And that might be the time to be looking at that instead of getting all geared up for something that's only going to be here for a few more months. That might be something to talk about initially.
Well, I see, but this is the pilot that you're showing us.
This is all the Oklahoma pilot.
Okay.
The national system will may not look exactly like this, but it'll have the same features and all of that. But that might be the place to look at that. But we can talk about that.
So if you guys can do it, I know a lot of people are validating the LIDAR data. Do you have a contact information for those of us who want to get east on some LIDAR data? Sorry, good luck.
Be the best one, Jim.
One thing that we've been doing with it is, as we get it, because it's public domain data, we've been sending a copy to our National Cardo Center, who is given to the AROS data center. And the plan was to make it available for download through them. And my understanding was that our Cardo Center, I don't know how, Data Gateway, USDA, Data Gateway, where you can get aerial photos and topographic information, things of that nature. I think you could contact them and they were supposedly trying to come up with some kind of interactive viewer that would allow you to clip out. You know, the local office of Stillwater isn't really geared up with storage space to clip pieces out, but I would just go through the website on the Data Gateway if you know what that is.
Because I sent an email to Steve Chero.
Steve the Chero, yeah, he's the one.
And I haven't heard anything back yet. That was just
okay. Well,
he'd be a good.
He's in charge of it.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what I've heard.
He's a busy boy. He didn't get right back, but he will get back.
He will get back. Yeah.
If you've got an area of interest that covers what's already been released, we've got that available too. And I'll give that out to some folks that have asked. Just give me a shape file that shows your area of interest. I can get those tiles and get them out to you on the FTP site.
Okay, great.
So at some time in the future, if you're interested in the dam watch, we do live demos of those too when you get in. And if and when it ever rains again, we'll have some more tests on the alert system and show some products in terms of showing a storm moving across the state. And you can also tie into a particular dam, so you can call up the radar at that time to see, has that storm come across that dam, or is it on top of it, or is it already passed as the waves come through? And if you've got one that's getting kind of touchy, you can kind of monitor as it goes and where the storm fronts are and the radar system. So it's a lot of fun.
Larry, I have one more comment. I mean, other than the fact that this is great, one of the things I noticed on one of the printouts on the alerts was it gave the time to maximum inundation, I believe.
Yes.
Is there any thought to altering that or giving it another one, saying like time to 2 feet or something? I mean, because time to maximum doesn't, you know, if it
you may be floated feet, away by that time.
You know, by 2 feet, you're done, or some level.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, that's one of the easy outputs from the system in there. And you have to keep in mind that when you're trying to model a dam failure, you're making a lot of assumptions.
Sure.
You know, on how quick a failure it is, at what location is it, what the area downstream is. Is it very channelized and it flushes downstream, or does it
So we don't want to put a whole lot of thought in there saying, well, that says an hour and 20 minutes, and after all, we're only an hour and 10 minutes, so we still have some time.
Right.
That's not, it's an indicator. Right. It's an indicator to prioritize your work. You know you want to take those that are within 10 minutes before you get those that are 2 hours. But to put much more faith than that in the whole thing, it's an indicator level. And that's one of the reasons why you really need to be careful as far as having exposure to this, because people could jump to a conclusion that's not right.
And one thing that's is a little different on a breach versus a flood is, you know, some of those structures are small, they hit the max and then they're gone within just a, you know, exactly. It's more like a wave than it is a gradual rising. So I don't know how, whether that can be computed perfectly or not, Mark.
Just wondering.
Okay. Thank you again for the opportunity to show off some of this work.
Thank you very much.
Item is just a general discussion of any GIS issues or data issues that anyone might have. Does anyone have anything on those they'd like to bring up at the moment? I might just brief you a little bit on a meeting that was held yesterday. Like most everyone knows, the state's going through an IT consolidation process. I guess for what, probably 2 years into that almost, the very start of that. And there's been a lot of concern about within the GIS community how that was going to impact our workflow, people, and that sort of thing. And you know, we're working through that. I think I can tell you, based on at least the folks I've talked with, is that, you know, initially we thought, you know, all the GIS people were going to be sucked into one agency out of all the agencies, and I don't think that's going to happen. I think recognize the fact that GIS specialists perform functions in agencies that are really pretty specific to that agency, because you have to have a specific knowledge of the business processes within each agency in order to address those processes efficiently for folks to solve their problems. You have to be familiar with specific data sets and that sort of thing. I think that's being recognized. On the other hand, there may be some specific GIS systems out there that might require a lot of high-end IT support, and individuals that could be more heavily involved in those activities might end up being transferred into the ISD section of owners. But that's, you know, that remains to be seen yet. The main thing that we were looking at yesterday was a group from DEQ, Water Board, and Agriculture, Health is there, was to kind of see how we can define how the IT community can support GIS efforts within agencies. And we came to the conclusion, I think, the place to start is actually with our data, centralizing our data. And, you know, we've started the process, you know, here with the council in looking at data stewards, people that are responsible for specific data layers. And we've got data spread across a lot of different agencies and groups. And we do have a data steward now for hydrology, the Water Resources Board. And I think next step are to look at our framework data, like transportation, like partial data, like imagery, elevation, and some of the others, to define those that would be the keepers of the data, so to speak, the stewards, the responsible persons or entities for those data sets. And also look at our standards, like we are with the GRES standards and other standards out there, and work at it from that aspect right now. And then we'll let the IT thing kind of evolve, because when you get down to it, we're talking about statewide geospatial data here. And that's much broader than state agencies. That involves everyone in the state, every local entity out there, every regional entity, every
unit of government out there is involved in that process. We want to be able to support everybody in what they're doing. You know, the best data is the local data. And the whole concept is to build it once and use it many times. And it has to begin at the ground local level. And I think that's where we need to head our efforts. It's going to take time to do that. But that's a goal that I have, and I think a lot of folks in here do as well. So we're going to begin with looking at data stewards and some of those layers, asking people to step up to the plate to take responsibility for these. And beyond framework, there's a lot of just basic thematic data out there. It's either derived from some of the themes, or it's just it's agency data that maybe applies to several agencies, or maybe just apply to one. At any rate, we just need to identify those that are responsible for those data sets and maintain them and look to them. Keeping that coming. So that's kind of where we're heading, and glad to have anybody join in that wishes to. Anybody like to make any comments, you're certainly welcome to. Otherwise, we'll move on. Okay, any new business anybody have? Okay, hearing none. How about announcements? I know we've got a SCOG conference coming up.
Got a SCOG conference coming up September the 24th, 25th, 26th, 27th. 25th, it's going to be a big one. We've actually hit the 300 mark, and they're, I think, crawling on the top of it now. So there's going to be a lot of people there, which we're sitting there going, how are we going to logistically, and we'll take care of it. If you want to come to the best GIS conference in Oklahoma, the biggest one that's got the most players, this is it. This is the biggest year I think we've ever had, bar one. It was just kind of an oddball deal, but we're still real close to those numbers. And we still got 3 weeks for registration, so we'll get probably pretty really close to those. Go on SCOG.org. I think there's still a couple of seats open for some training classes, maybe. They're going really, really quickly. We're getting close enough to have to think about cutting off some numbers, so if you're interested in coming, go online and sign up. So, and also there's some training opportunities out there. Browse around if you think that you might like to have some training. You can get two or three people together to start a seed class. Come and talk to Shelly or I, and we'll see if we can get some training started. So, SCOG.org for the conference.
Anything else? Anybody
want to
add?
I have some flyers around people about that. It's a little brochure about our new EQ, our TED viewer on the left. So, grab a flyer, or we're going to be presenting a talk to you.
Okay, next meeting. We're going to October the 5th, first Friday in October. Not sure what we're going to have there. We don't have a speaker lined up, do we?
Not officially. We have a couple that are interested.
All right. If there's nothing else for the good of the day, I entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
And a second?
Second.
Those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Thank you. Have a great weekend, everybody. Have a nice
I have a question.
Mexico. I'm my first year, so here. That should be included. And that's pretty much,
Did you go to the Nunchong?
Okay.